This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, a podcast about the United States and the world in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. I'm your host, Michael Patrick Cullinane. Welcome back to the show. Sometimes there are guests that are just such great fun, and this week I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Natalie Dykstra. Natalie is an emeritus professor at Hope College. She's an honorary fellow at the Massachusetts Historical Society, and she has an amazing biography of Isabella Stewart Gardner, someone who's probably most famous for her museum, the Fenway Court Museum, better known nowadays as the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. And you might also know that museum from a 2021 documentary. When I was binging on Netflix and watching this documentary, Natalie was writing and researching about Isabella Stewart Gardner. And during the pandemic, this documentary came out called This is a Robbery. And the story is of a robbery in the 1990s in Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum that has still gone unsolved. It's really an exceptional book, and the book got a great write-up in the New York Times. Please welcome to the show, Natalie Dykstra.
Oh, wow. I'm looking so forward to it. Thank you for making such a warm welcome.
All right. Well, when I do biographies, I do like to start off by asking a very similar question, which hopefully allows you to introduce this character. So who is Isabella Stewart Gardner? And why should we care about her?
That is a question that's preoccupied me for the last 10 years, as you can imagine. And it's a question that was asked at her time. There was an article written in the opening of her museum, her eponymous museum in 1903, that said, who is this woman who created this extraordinary palace? So she was an extraordinary figure of the 19th century, at the turn of the century, for a lot of different reasons. She lived a very long life. She was born in 1840 and died in 1924. So before the Civil War, and she lived into modernism. So she really lived the span of America's turning into its global power. And her personal life is that she was one of the most important art collectors in America, and certainly the first to build a building to house her collection. So she designed Fenway Court, which is what the museum was called at the time, before her death in 1924. She designed it from foundation to roof, and then she installed her collection. There were other collections that were put into mansions like Frick's in New York, but that building stood already. So she was the first to design from the ground up. And she had one of the most important collections of Italian Renaissance art in the United States, and also the first Vermeer in Boston, the second in America. So she had a lot of firsts. First Matisse was in her collection. She was a very important cultural leader of the time. So it was not only the art that she collected for her museum, but it was also all the concerts that she hosted, all the artists and musicians that she was a patron of. Her friends were Henry James and John Singer Sargent and Anders Zorn and Whistler. And it's a big cast of characters. So she had this very big American life. There's a wonderful photograph of her talking practically on her tiptoes with Teddy Roosevelt at a graduation at Groton in the 1913. And they are so animated talking to each other. They had so much to say to each other. And I had that image in front of me as I was writing, because they have a similar sort of optimism or intensity, drive. She filled a room like T.R. did. She could fill a room. So she's a very, she had a long life and a big personality. And yet in some ways, her great accomplishment, this extraordinary museum, ended up overshadowing her life story. And then the theft in 1990, which is probably how the Gardner Museum is most known in the world, which is a theft that's still unsolved. The theft of 13 pieces of art, paintings and other works of art, that overshadowed the museum for a while. So there was these two shadowings of her story. So I felt like there was an opportunity to see how close I could get to her story and tell a cradle to grave account. And I had a hunch that I would find things. I had a hunch that there was more to discover. And I did. I did discover some wonderful sources in other repositories, but also at the museum.
Yeah, you certainly did. You did discover some great things. I mean, I want to kind of go blow by blow through her life, because you've got the book.
Yes, I would love that.
Yeah, no, the book is well divided too, because you see these fault lines and these cleavages in her life where there's major turning points. And I love that you mentioned that photo with TR, because I think you're right. If we have a candidate who like best exemplifies or symbolizes or embodies the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, Gardner is one of them for sure, I think.
Yes. And yet it's interesting that she somehow gets off to the side in other people's accounts. So she's often referred to in many, many other biographies, but she doesn't ever really quite, I wanted to put her right at the center of a big book. You know, the museum has wonderful accounts of their founder, and readers should turn to the museum's accounts for sure, because they have a different angle to her than I took. But those books are smaller and they're more about the paintings, right? And they're more about the collection, which makes sense. So it's I wanted her to really take center stage.
Well, she's got her place here, obviously. And take us to New York, because her story doesn't begin in Boston, although that's where she's most famous. That's her husband's family, of course, and we'll get to him in a moment. But tell us about her upbringing in New York.
She was born in 1840. On 10 University Place, right near Washington Square Park. And she went to school around the corner in a building that was later bought by Gertrude Whitney, and is still, I think, an art school there on Clinton Place. And then she went to Grace Church, which was within walking distance, the Episcopal Church. And that was the most important church in most fashionable church in New York at the time. It had the highest steeple that you could see from the harbor. And her father was one of the founding members. And that was really an early discovery in my research, that there was this connection to Grace Church. And so I went there, and there's this extraordinary stained glass window that her parents put up in memory of her three siblings who were younger than her and who had all died by 1881. So her parents were still living, and they erected this beautiful stained glass window called the Stuart Family Window, actually, and in memory of her siblings. And I went to a service there, and the music just filled this nave. I was so struck by the connection of that Stuart family window with the stained glass windows at the museum, and there are several. And I thought there's a through line there that her parents had responded to this catastrophic loss of their children, three of their four children, by erecting this memorial window. And I felt like that had that connection hadn't been made before. So that really kind of helped me open up her, it made it, I knew I wanted to have New York be a real felt presence, and what it was to be a growing up on Broadway. And as that was so full of shops and people and fashion, and I used a lot of Henry James's description in his memoir of growing up in New York. They didn't, the families were nearby each other, but I never found a record that they knew each other directly. And of course, she and Henry James were later friends. But she really identified as a New York girl. You know, I have a scene of her a little bit later going to see a painting by Church, enormous painting that one of the shops on Broadway had on display. And that was enormous fun to sort of imagine her in those, in that early time in New York City. And then she went to, and her father, I just want to say a couple things about her father, David Stuart. There's not a lot of material or representation of Stuart in the museum, but I didn't believe that that meant that they didn't have a close affinity. They looked almost identical. I have a portrait of both of them that where you can really see the resemblance. And he would give her these beautiful, beautiful, extraordinary books for gifts. And they were often about Shakespeare's women or important women in history. And I always felt like he was communicating to her that she was special and that she too could be an important woman in history. I love that little, those little moments where you're in the archive and you're looking at these dedications in books, you know, like to Isabella from, and it's very, the inscriptions are very modest. It's not like they say a lot, but they tell what gifts he's giving her seemed important to me. So, or telling. And so I think he traded in Irish and Scottish linen mostly. And I felt like his trade in fabrics and textiles and linen was a connection to her fascination with textiles as well later in her life, that she was very attracted to a fashion and the way she put textiles on the walls in the museum in such a subtle and extraordinary way. I felt that there was a link there with her father. So that's her, kind of her New York time. I will say this, she would retreat to New York on occasion. You know, she would kind of escape back to New York. Sometimes Boston was so much smaller. It just felt more closed.
And New York seems even small for her sometimes too, when she's an international woman as well. And she looks to women that were powerful, like her Scottish lineage, she traces yes. back in. And then obviously to the Mary Queen of Scots, she was hoping for a connection there, but maybe didn't find it. But then also she goes to Paris in her early years as well, before the Civil War. She's a young woman. She's at boarding school. And that period that she's in Paris seems so transformational in her life.
And unknown. This has not been known before. There was a name, you know, So for me, with biography, it's always about the material. It's always about the archives, what's in the archives. And so you want to look at friendship albums, and you want to look at signatures, and you want to look at how they addressed envelopes, and you know, nothing is sort of too small in a sense, or peripheral in a sense. Sometimes that can be the clue that you need. And so her friendship albums, I transcribed those, and then I just started to search those names. And there was an entry that said Julia Gardner, Boston. Well, we know that's Jack Gardner's sister. And we did know that she had, when she went to this Paris school when she was 15, her parents took her and she met Julia Gardner. So we knew that connection. But then the next name was Helen Waterston, also of Boston. And I thought, who's Helen Washington? And thanks to Archive Grid, the wonderful search engine that we have now, up popped the Massachusetts Historical Society, and Helen Waterston's papers were there. And she had 6 daily diaries that she kept for her education in Paris. And in the second diary, I turned a page and it said, there were 2 girls from, how did it say this? Helen, she said, Julie and I met Isabella Stewart, a New York girl. I thought, holy cow, there she is, a teenager. And it's, you know, it was, that is thrilling. That's a thrilling moment.
She met so many other people in Paris as well.
I mean, and she met so many other people in Paris. And so she, and Helen was such a good describer of the scene, right? So I knew what her teachers were like. I knew what she was learning. I knew what church they went to. I knew how they studied, how strict the school was. And it was very clear to me from that, the description of the education, first of all, how smart she was, how much fun she was. There was this great word that Helen used, that she had a talent for jollification. And the Times picked up on that in the review. I love that. But yeah, so there's a way in which you think, who she is as a teenager kind of rhymes with who she becomes. You can see the connection. And that was really, that's always a nice moment for a biographer. Also because it hadn't been known before. It was, I think I say in the book something, it was as if she was Athena coming out of Zeus's head. You know, she came, and instead she came from somewhere. And I really wanted to know where that was. So Grace Church became really important in all their records. And then also this record by Helen Waterston. So, you know, it was fun to track down Harriet Beecher Stowe's daughters were in Paris at the same time. They were on the other side of the Seine, but at a different school. But Helen was reading Stowe's fiction. So you could imagine them talking about this famous American writer that was there. So there were all kinds of scenes that you could build from those diaries. And then she comes back and she's already very sophisticated. She can speak French and Italian. She's learned German. She's really extraordinarily sophisticated at 19. And of course, she's seen all this art. They also, after Paris, traveled to Florence and then, of course, Milan. And that's where she, at 15 or 16, I think she is by then, she is with another friend, Ida Agassiz. And she says to Ida, after they have seen the collection at Pulte Pozzoli, which is now a museum, but at the time was a house museum, a private house museum. And she said, if ever I have money of my own, I want to build a palace and fill it with beautiful things. And that was, so I, when I traveled, I had a chance to travel before the pandemic, thank goodness. And I went to the Pulte Pozzoli and imagined her as a teenager having this dream. And then what is that like to be able to fulfill that dream? I found that very powerful. I mean, to have the record of her saying it and then to know what's coming.
A big part of that puzzle surely is her, if we're talking about places, Boston, her move to Boston, but her husband as well, because the Gardeners, they're a big deal in Boston.
They're a big deal in Boston, right? And they meet in Paris, though. It's very clear that they have lots of time together in Paris, not together as a couple, but together in a group, in a family group, and that their parents knew each other so well. They would stay, their mothers, so Mrs. Stewart and Mrs. Gardner stayed in a hotel while those girls were in school. And so they were all in a, you know, they knew each other very, very well.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
And Boston rivaled New York for finance, like in terms of like State Street was on par with the likes of, well, J.P. Morgan wasn't even around back then.
No.
The finance world and the merchant class kind of, they were in Boston. And
yes, that's right. You have that exactly right. That's where the financials, exactly right. The Gardners were a powerful financial family for sure. And they also, they were so smart about real estate. Jack Gardner's father. Let me back up a minute just to, so that I could get where, how they met a minute. So they met in Paris and knew each other quite well. Then when they all come back to America, then Julia invites Isabella to Boston. And then within that visit, it's clear that there's a romance that develops and a proposal in that first visit to Boston. So, and then they soon after marry in 1860. And Jack Gardner, as you say, is part of this important part of the merchant class, the Brahmins here in Boston. And there was some resentment, I think, because, of course, he was very eligible bachelor, right? He had many choices, and she was from elsewhere. She was from elsewhere. And I got very interested in all the images of Marie Antoinette in the museum. They're not so obvious, but there's a wonderful little portrait in the little salon on the second floor before you get into the tapestry room in a vitrine. And then in the archives, there's a list of early purchases that Jack Gardner made. He kept track of all their art purchases. And this is in the 18th, just after they're married. And he kept buying her prints of Marie Antoinette. So I was reading Carolyn Weber's brilliant book on the Queen of Fashion about Marie Antoinette and her fashion. And I thought, that's very interesting because it's also about someone from elsewhere and being rejected. And I thought, what is he telling her with that, with those portraits of Marie Antoinette? And then I had a record that she kept of everything she could keep in her bedroom. She kept those prints that Jack had given her all those years ago. And I thought that was very telling, that there was some way that they're communicating in that way. I'm getting in the weeds about biography, about how you sort of build these scenes, but
I mean, what do you think about her fitting in, though? I mean, that's the real question that I wanted to get to about the Gardners is, yeah, she is from elsewhere. And the Marie Antoinette connection is brilliant. That's great. But what's your reading on, like, brass tacks? Does she fit in Boston?
No, not initially. It's clear. It's partly that she was from outside. I think it was also because she just didn't obey those Brahmin rules. And those Brahmin rules were arcane, you know, hieroglyphic, as Edith Wharton said about New York society. It was a nod here, a smile there, a closed door there. These minor gestures meant enormous amounts right? They signaled so much about status and where you belonged. And whether she was not able to read those signals, whether there was jealousy that she had married into the Gardner family, whether she talked too much at a dinner, or, you know, it's just hard to exactly know, but it is the case that she was not invited to what was called sewing circles in the sort of these women's networks in Boston. And once you were in a sewing circle, and people did more than sewing, they, you know, they did social causes, and, but it was kind of your identity, your social identity. And once you got excluded from that, you just couldn't enter in. You just couldn't enter in. I mean, Boston was this, I just want to say this about Boston, it's tight, this incredible tight social weave, more so than New York, more so than other, you could enter into society. I mean, it was hard. It was difficult. But Boston, even if you married in, you still are an outsider. You know, in the 1840s, a lot of these families are descended from the revolutionary generation, right? And so they have this sense of incredible citizenship, or like, we built this country and we need to build these institutions. And that's a strength, right? We still have so many of those wonderful institutions here that they built in that generation. But it also had this patrolled the borders of who could belong and who didn't belong. And she was just on the outside of that. And so that was very painful. That was very painful. And Jack, I think, was reassuring her. I think if he that family was so much fun to write about, because there was so much to discover. There's all these unpublished papers at the Mass Historical Society. And the way they talked, these brothers talked to each other, was very, very interesting. So, you know, how do I want to say this? I think over a long period of time, people started to accept her invitations because they didn't want to miss out, right? As she sort of rose in society, people started to accept her more and more. But there was always, I think they always did kind of hold her at a distance, at some remove.
The other big thing that happens, though, that makes this early part of her life rocky is loss and death. So so she has two miscarriages, which are heartbreaking, but nothing like the death of her only child. That seems to change her completely. And to boot, all of this is happening as the Civil War is going on, and the nation is itself convulsing through this identity crisis.
Yes.
So
yes.
How do we... I don't know. How did you come to write that?
Extraordinary. That's in chapter four. It's titled Remaining Dear Ones. It was a line that Jack Gardner wrote to his brother after his brother lost two of his children in a cholera outbreak in France. And, you know, and it all happens in a very tight, in 1 year that this Gardner family loses how many children? Three children and a sister-in-law within a couple months, all within within a year. And then these letters that are, because they're apart from each other, that are moving across the Atlantic, are so moving. And they're in their 20s. They're so young. And they're talking about ultimate things, you know, about how do we, you know, how do you think of this level of loss or this scale of this loss and not have your life ruined? You know, how do you move forward from it? So let me just tell the story a little bit. They were married in 1860, and 5 months, 6 months later, she had a stillborn little boy that is, who was later reburied with Jackie. Then Jackie's born, and at just before he turns two, a month before the Civil War ends, he dies of flu or pneumonia, or there's multiple different records of what it was, pleurisy or... I had a research student track the flu season that year just to see how many children died in Boston. So she loses little Jackie, and he was such a cute little kid. And he was already speaking in sentences at 18 months. He was so smart. And then she's pregnant. Her doctor says, you know, you must not get pregnant again. It's too risky. And she does. And then she loses that pregnancy and a miscarriage at the end of that year. And so, and then she's really warned, you know, you will not live. If she almost died with that miscarriage. And so now she's 26 and she's on Beacon Street, which is the kind of main of the Back Bay here in Boston. And there's all these little kids running up and down the street. And now what do you do? You know, you just, I really felt for her because so much of being a woman in that era was being a mother. And so all her, I think of all those Thanksgivings and Christmases that she went to, holidays she went to at Jack's sister, Julia Gardner, who had five sons, all blonde and blue-eyed. In fact, they gave, Isabella gave Jackie's cradle to Julia and her husband on the birth of their third boy, I think. And I think, did she stand in that doorway and see that little boy, that Julia's little boy in Jackie's cradle? I mean, I just wanted to, you have to let yourself imagine that. I would write a lot in my writing journals about some of these scenes, just not that I would want to put them directly into the book, but just so that I could kind of have them there as temperature, like kind of the temperature of the story. And then I found myself incredibly moved by, you know, she has a long depression. Probably it was called a multiple things. They wouldn't have said a depression, neurasthenia, hysteria, all these different diagnoses of the time. And then she has the travel cure. And Jack, and it's something her Jack's family also took. Jack's mother sometimes struggled with depression and would travel in response to it. And so they went off to Northern Europe and she revived. And it was so clear from that first travel album that she, you know, her eye, her sense of design, even in that travel album, how careful she was in pasting things into the pages. I've seen so many other travel albums of other women of the 19th century, and they're sort of hodgepodgey and not Isabella's, you know, it's like very precise. And I thought, oh, there she is. You know, that's like putting paintings on the wall. Not quite yet, but it's, you know, those travel diaries were a big clue for her recovery. And then I just started to understand that her eye, her capacity to respond saved her. And she revived and she had to decide who else to be. She wasn't going to be who she thought she was going to be, and she had to be somebody else. And then really how to tell that story. So I got very drawn to that shape. The shape of her life became incredibly interesting to me.
In a way, all the parts of your book are that, you know, okay, something happens, some trauma, I go away, I travel, I become somebody else. I mean, her travels are incredible. I'm very jealous. I love the travel. And I look at as I was reading your story, I'm like, oh my God, she's going away again. I mean, she's in the Middle East, she's in India, she's in Japan. And each one of those trips shape her in some way, right?
Yeah, they do. They do. And I was writing those during the pandemic, right? So I was like,
oh no, that's tough.
I would have their itineraries. I still have their list of what they did when, you know, all taped to my wall. And I have these three ring binders of anytime I could track what they were doing day by day, I had to keep those, that very careful tracking of them. And so, and then I could let my imagination go, right? And so, yeah, that was enormous. It is. And she did not fatigue like Jack did. There's these wonderful brief entries in Jack's letters to in his diaries, but then also in his letters to his nephews saying things like, Auntie Belle is off shopping and I am to take a nap. So, you know, he didn't have quite the energy that she did, but yeah, just her. I was saying to a friend, how ravenous she was for experience, for to see and to hear and to know. I just love that, that extraordinary curiosity that she had was really, it was remarked upon. It was remarked upon by the Gardner family. Jack's older brother would remark upon it, saying, you know, she is untiring. Your Auntie Belle is untiring, he'd say. So, I mean, yeah. And she was kind of exhausting, even to me.
She does have a chance to kind of become a mother in a surrogate kind of way. Her husband's brother dies, and the three boys that they had are orphaned, and Jack and Isabella take them in. I mean, these boys are pretty interesting too. I mean, Gussie Gardner is going to run for Senate, and he is a congressman. I mean, so anyway, adopting these three kids, how does that change the life of those three young boys and their new guardians? Because their life changes too.
Yeah, so it's a sad, I mean, it's such an interesting story. So I'm just going to go back a little bit. So Joe is the oldest Gardner brother, Jack's oldest brother, and he is married to a woman named Harriet. And Harriet has her last of three boys, and a month later she dies. And Isabella and Jack live close to them, and they're called to the house. And Isabella is with Joe, and it's clear that she tends to Harriet's body. You know, I have evidence, and it's in my end notes, that, you know, she really showed up for the family. She moved toward that tragedy, not away from it. And so there was this bond between her and her brother-in-law, Joseph Gardner. Then in 18, Joe commits suicide, Joseph. And he has these, of course, they have no mom, and they have these three boys, and they're quite young. And so it's obvious that it's Jack and Isabella that are going to take these kids. But I have a hunch that agreement started earlier, after Harriet's death. I don't have that proof because I don't have anybody saying it in a letter or in a diary entry. But I have a hunch that was, if anything happens to me, I need someone to take care of these boys. Now, they also did go to boarding school, right? So it's not like they were in the home 12 months out of the year, but it is very much the case that she loved to read novels to them. She took it very seriously, her role, and Jack wrote them copious letters through the years. And then they went to Harvard, and, you know, they had, and then tragically, the oldest boy, also named Joseph, also died by suicide. And that was a really traumatic death, because Isabella and Jack were traveling at the time, and they got the telegram. And it was always scary to get telegrams when you're traveling and you're really far away, because you never knew what news you were going to get. And so there's a scene that I have of her, that she kept a memory box of a picture of her and Jack and little Jackie, and then also a picture of Joseph Jr. When he was a little older, as if that this was her family. She was going to remember that this was their family.
The point that I'm making, I guess, about those kids is that she had she touched people's lives in a very intimate way. And it's not just likes of the Gardner boys. She's got this, you mentioned it earlier, there's a huge cast of characters. So you rattled off some names there: Henry and Clover Adams, Charles Elliott Norton, the president of
Yes.
Harvard.
Yes, Whistler, he's an Sergeant. Incredibly important character. So important. Charles Elliott Norton is such
right. I mean,
an
he kind of
character.
Like turned her on to a bunch of ideas. Yes. And can you talk about William Morris Hunt, Henry James? And as I'm reading all of these, I just had one question in my mind: did she have a favorite?
Oh, I mean, Charles Loeffler. She adored the violinist Charles Loeffler. I mean, just, you know, he struggled. I mean, he was so talented, and he was kind of ahead of his time. And she loved music as much as she loved art. You know, I really wanted the book to have as much music as I could. And Charles Loeffler was one of her favorites, you know. And also, I think John Singer Sargent was such a how do I want to say? I'm very moved by the end of their friendship. Like, they were friends to the very end of their lives, and they died just a year apart. I think he died just 1 year later. And of course, there was a way he understood her character so profoundly, both in the iconic 1888 portrait that he has, and then this amazing watercolor sketch that he makes in 1922. And then the exchange of letters that they have in that 1918-17, when he's in Boston doing all the murals that he's doing. And there's these wonderful sort of meet me at a hotel for dinner, come to Fenway Court. There's a lot of back and forth between them. And I love how he's the first artist in residence at Fenway Court when it opens. So he's there in 1904. I really enjoy, I always loved when it was a Sargent day and I could write about him. Because can I say one other thing about Sargent? He is so generous. He's such a generous man. There's a kindness in him that I really loved thinking about and seeing. Henry James has a very Henry Jamesian ambivalence. He's fascinated by a gardener, and he's just like, oh my God, here she comes. You know, he has these funny letters where he sort of says things and then backs up and says things. So I love that, writing about James. And he's such a reliable reporter, right? So I love, you know, some days when you get sort of inspiration, where do you go for inspiration? You just turn to Henry James letters, and there you are, have it. I love his letters. And then I love her relationship with Henry Adams, because of course I wrote about Henry Adams in my first book with Clover Adams, and it was Adams who thought she was fabulous. I mean, just really admired her so much. And I didn't expect that from Henry Adams. I thought he would be a little more removed, and instead, he really understands what she's trying to accomplish with Fenway Court, and he admires that she does it in Boston, because he, of course, has fled from Boston, and it's cold roast Boston, as he would call it, you know, and it's critical nature. He fled to Washington, you know, in the 1870s with or 1880s with Clover, so 1870s. And so I think he particularly admires Isabella, because she tries to do a big thing in Boston, and he really admires that. And so that was enormously, also his letters are extraordinary. So there's so many. Anders Zorn is a great character. And of course, I was so grateful to the museum that I was able to have that as my cover, because I think it's her in action, stepping off the balcony at the Palazzo Barbaro in Venice, and Anders Zorn, a Swedish painter that she first meets at the Columbia, the Chicago World's Fair, and buys a painting there, and then really fosters his career in Boston, makes possible shows for him. And so he writes these wonderful letters about, he writes one letter where he says to her, "Your letters make me love life." And then you think, oh, I would love to find those letters, but I wasn't able to find her letters to Zorn. Like, what was it about her letters that made him say that? So the list is long. The list is long. And when you have that many characters, you have to kind of cast your book. You have to kind of decide which ones come to the front of the stage and why. And that was hugely challenging, because the list was so long. 100,000 correspondents. There's 1,000 names in the correspondence list at the museum.
Incredible. I mean, the museum itself seems to be the thing that is really her, what people, they sort of entryway into her life.
Yes.
In a lot of regards. And I guess, although Fenway Court, or the Isabella Gardner Museum now, although it's really known in its day for Renaissance art, there is other stuff there. I mean, you mentioned the Matisse and other modern artists. I mean, you also mentioned in the book that she attended the Armory Show. And
she- yes. Yes. She was an honorary part of the, you know, she was listed on the program for the Armory Show. They reached out to her.
Well, what is her thoughts about the changing nature of art, modern art, abstract art? What are her thoughts?
Oh, I would, you know, I know she was interested. That's what I know. She was unafraid of the future. So sometimes the museum, because it's about the past, she was not nostalgic about the past. It's not a place of nostalgia. It's a place of memory. It's a palace of memory, but it's not nostalgic. She was absolutely forward looking. So she was fascinated by Matthew Sturt Pritchard's letters from Paris. And Matthew Sturt Pritchard had been for a time a curator at the MFA, and they had become friends. And he had actually stayed at Fenway Court in the McKnight Room, which is now the McKnight Room, but was a small little apartment room. And so they knew each other very well. And then there was some conflict with the MFA, and he went to Paris, and he would write to her about being in Matisse's studio outside of Paris as he's doing those great La Danse, you know, those big blue and red paintings. Oh, I just loved, and it was like firsthand reports, you know. And then I don't have her letters to him back, but Pritchard would often quote her back to her in the correspondence. So then I could get little snippets of her responses to, you say to me, you know, tell me all I know, you know, tell me all I, yeah, tell you all I know. And so she, you know, she loved hearing of what was happening. I do know she went to galleries when she was in 1906. She was in Paris with with Adams at the same time. Henry Adams was there at the same time. And they would motor around Paris in his white Mercedes to look at old cathedral glass. And there's great sort of letters. Both of them have letters about that tour. And but she also would go to contemporary galleries to see what was current. But I don't have a specific letter about that. I know that she, you know, her Monet portrait of Monet's of his mother is, if you put a picture of there's one picture of Gardner's mother and you put that Monet, it's almost, they're the same generation and they look so similar. I love that resemblance. And then she has a beautiful Degas, and she has, and of course this Matisse that was given to her, but it still counts as the first Matisse in an American collection. So it's not that she was uninterested in what's happening. And also the first floors of the museum are filled with her contemporaries. So more John Singer Sargent's, and the McKnight Room is named after Dodge McKnight, who studied with Van Gogh, is an extraordinary watercolorist, and a wonderful work by Paul Manship that I have at the end of the book, a wonderful statue in the McKnight Room. So it's just that I think that I think a lot of Boston collectors were collecting Monet, Claude Monet at the time. And I think she just didn't want to, that's already here in the city, right? She wanted some distinction between other collections and her collection. So I think some of that was at play. So yeah, she was not afraid of the future. You know, and technology too. She loved cars. She was fascinated by airplanes. She anything that moved fast. She loved things that move fast.
She's so fun. I can see why, you know, you'd write a biography about it. There's so much there to love. And the book has got so much more than what we've covered in the podcast. I mean, you mentioned a little bit about music fills your pages. And yes. Also something that I was really glad you talked about was that you know, you had to do research in other places because there's not a lot of her in one place, but she's everywhere in everyone else's papers. The New York Times picked up on that in the review. And Natalie, this book is super. I hope everyone goes out and buys a copy because it's really exceptional.
Oh, my God. That's so kind of you to say. And what a wonderful conversation that we had together. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's all we have time for. Thanks for listening. You can follow The Gilded Age and Progressive Era on Twitter or on my website, michaelpatrickcullinane.com. Please consider subscribing or reviewing the podcast wherever you listen because it really makes a big difference and helps direct others to the show. I hope you'll join me again for the next episode.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.